This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, welcome to The World Today. I'm Eleanor Hall. This Wednesday, chaos in Venezuela. Protesters take to the streets of Caracas as the opposition leader calls on the army to overthrow the Maduro government. And the Liberal Party dumps a candidate over anti-Muslim comments. The family of Australian woman Justine Ruzcek wants the murder conviction of her killer to mark a turning point in US law enforcement culture. As an on-duty Minneapolis police officer, Mohammed Noor shot Ms. Ruzcek dead outside her home after she'd called police to report a possible sexual assault. On-duty police officers kill around 1,000 people each year in the United States, and Ms. Damond Ruzcek's supporters say they hope the guilty verdict will see this number drop. But black victims of police violence are not optimistic. Samantha Donovan begins our coverage.
After a two-year fight for justice, Justine Damond Ruzcek's father, John Ruzcek, says the family is satisfied with the verdicts.
The jury's decision reflects the community's commitment to three important pillars of a civil society: the rule of law, the respect for the sanctity of life, and the obligation of the police force to serve and protect. We believe this guilty verdict strengthens those pillars. We hope this will be a catalyst for further change.
The Minneapolis jury found Mohammed Noor guilty of third-degree murder and second-degree manslaughter, but they acquitted him on the charge of second-degree murder, which requires the prosecution to prove the accused intended to cause the death. Observers of the case estimate he'll be sentenced to 10 to 15 years in jail. Ms. Damond Ruzcek's fiancé, Don Damond, says the evidence showed the egregious failure of the Minneapolis Police Department.
Ironically, the Minneapolis Police Department emblem on the squad door reads, "To protect with courage and to serve with compassion." I implore the Minneapolis Mayor Jacob Frey and Police Chief Maderia Arredondo to do everything they can to ensure that these essential human values are not just words on a car door, but are lived values of every person in the police department who need a complete transformation of policing in Minneapolis and around the country.
The prosecutor, Hennepin County Attorney Mike Freeman, believes the jury made the right decision.
You know, when you look at police shooting cases in this country, over the last 12 years, there's been 12,000 police shootings. Only 95 of them have been prosecuted, and less than half of those have been successfully prosecuted. This was one because I think we did our job and we had to do it all.
But Minneapolis civil rights lawyer and activist Nakima Levy-Armstrong has told ABC 24 there's a mixed reaction to the verdict in the local community.
I live in a community in which black families are still grieving. Many of these officers who shoot and kill African-American victims and other people of color not only continue to keep their jobs, but they continue to patrol the same communities in which they've caused harm. They continue to collect a paycheck and a pension, and there's no accountability under the law. I know that if a white officer were to kill me or another African American today, that officer would not be charged. He would not be convicted. He would not even be fired from the police department. It is not a coincidence that the first officer to be charged with murdering a civilian while on duty in the state of Minnesota is a black Muslim Somali.
Mike Freeman rejects the suggestion that prosecutors gave Justine Damond Ruzcek's case greater priority than others.
I've heard a small group in the community make disparaging remarks about me and this office to the effect that I won't charge white cops who shoot black people, but I'll charge black cops who shoot white people. That simply is not true. Race has never been a factor in any of my decisions and never will be.
That's Mike Freeman, the prosecutor in the case, and Samantha Donovan with that report. Well, criminal justice professor at Bowling Green State University in Ohio, Dr. Philip Stinson, runs a detailed national database on police shootings in the United States. He's also a former police officer. He joined me earlier. Professor Stinson, welcome to The World Today.
Well, thank you for having me.
Now, this is the first time a Minneapolis police officer has been convicted for an on-duty killing in the state's history. Were you surprised by the guilty verdict for Mohammed Noor?
Well, I'm never surprised by a jury's verdict, but I'm never able to predict. These are very difficult cases. It's a very rare instance that an officer in the United States is actually charged with murder or manslaughter resulting from an on-duty shooting. By my research and counting this over the last 15 years, there have only been 101 officers charged in one of these cases. And Muhammad Noor is the 36th officer in the past 15 years to be convicted. So just 36 officers out of 101 who face charges. The fact of the matter is, though, that most officers are never criminally charged. And we know that between 900 and 1,000 times each year in the United States, on-duty police officers shoot and kill someone. And just a handful of times each year is an officer actually charged with any crime as a result of one of those shootings.
So your nationwide research database shows that there are up to 1,000 police killings each year, but roughly only 30 convictions?
Actually, 36 convictions over the last 15 years. We typically see anywhere from 1 to 15 officers charged a year, and just a few of those cases typically result in a conviction. It's very difficult to get a conviction in these cases. Juries are very reluctant to second-guess the split-second life-or-death decisions of police officers in potentially violent street encounters. And even though prosecutors in these cases make it very clear what the legal standard is, it's a very difficult burden that the prosecutors have. And frankly, in some of these cases, it seems that the juries nullify the verdict. They just simply ignore the legal requirements of justification for a sworn officer using deadly force, and they just are very reluctant to second guess.
You've been following Muhammad Noor's case closely, and of course you're a former police officer yourself. Do you think
That's right.
this case heralds a shift in the approach to prosecuting on-duty officers?
Well, you know, the prosecutor in this case, Mike Freeman, is the elected prosecutor there. They knew this was a difficult case going into it. You know, Mr. Freeman in a press conference over a year ago talked about how difficult it would be. He actually cited my research and statistics, and they knew it was going to be a difficult case. You know, typically prosecutors in this country only bring charges if they think they can win a case, if they can obtain a conviction. And in this instance, the prosecutor said going into it, we don't know if we can get a conviction, but our job is to seek justice, and this is the appropriate thing to do. And that's exactly what they did, and they ultimately achieved a conviction here.
So why do you think there was a conviction in this case?
I think the facts can't be rationally explained in this case. It doesn't make any sense at all that an officer sitting in a police car would shoot across the other officer who was sitting in the driver's seat at a shadowy figure. None of it made any sense. And if the facts don't make any sense, that's when we see convictions, the rare instance where an officer is convicted in one of these cases.
We've heard the county attorney this morning say that race played no part in this prosecution, but some people say that it has. To what extent do you think race played into this case?
Well, in the United States, anything with the criminal justice system, race is always the factor. So I think it's disingenuous to suggest that race played no factor. To some extent, I think absolutely race did come into play here. And here, you know, it's the reverse situation of what we typically see in this country in terms of the officer's race and the victim's race. But how significant a role it played, I don't know.
How do you think it would have played in this case? How do you think it would have affected the jury?
I think that it absolutely makes a difference that you have a white female victim and you have an immigrant, dark-skinned police officer. I don't know to what extent it played a role, but it obviously is something that was a factor in the case.
Justine Ruzcik's family members say they are satisfied that justice has been done with this guilty verdict, and they also say that they think it will have positive effects on policing in this country. Do you think, given what you're saying, that's too optimistic?
No, I don't. And I think that's a really appropriate and forward-thinking thing to say. You know, a lot of people are even critical of my research. I research police crime across the United States. But one of the main purposes of my research is to improve policing. And I think that this case can go a long way to improve policing. It's important that we reconsider the legal requirements for justification in officers using deadly force. I think I'm not sure what the appropriate standard is, but clearly this isn't working when we have so many people who are shot and killed by on-duty police officers each and every year.
So what changes do you think this case may prompt that will change that?
You know, there's so many different issues involved here. One of the issues is training, and many of our police officers in this country are former military officers, military personnel. They're combat veterans, and I question question whether they can be retrained as civilian police officers, because the rules of engagement as a soldier or a Marine or airman are completely different than the rules of when a police officer in the United States is legally justified in using deadly force.
Professor Stinson, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure.
And Dr. Philip Stinson is a criminal justice professor in Ohio who runs a national database on police shootings in the United States. This is The World Today. The Victorian Liberal Party has dumped one of its candidates in response to publicity over his online anti-Muslim rant. Jeremy Hearn suggested that Muslims were trying to overthrow the Australian government and introduce Sharia law. Political reporter Stephanie Boris has more.
Outside a pre-polling booth in the seat of Isaac's volunteers hand out how to vote cards. There's plenty of red and green, but as voter Kathleen points out, there's no blue to be seen.
There was no paperwork for the Liberals. He'd just dumped it and went.
The Liberals were hoping to pick up the seat, but they've dumped their candidate, Jeremy Hearn, for making anti-Muslim comments last year that have now resurfaced.
Those comments were appalling. I reject them entirely. I reject them absolutely.
Victoria's Liberal leader Michael O'Brien made it clear the party's far from happy with Mr Hearn.
Those views got no place in the Liberal Party at all.
Should he be sacked as candidate?
I think you'll see action on that very, very quickly.
The action was swift. Federal Liberal Minister Josh Frydenberg confirming the state division has disendorsed Jeremy Hearn.
Those comments were unacceptable. They have no place in the Liberal Party.
It follows comments Jeremy Hearn made last year. He posted them on Quadrant Magazine's website. He declared Muslims want to replace the government and legal system with Sharia law and were lying about their purpose to conceal their activities. Voters heading into the pre-polling booth had mixed responses, but some weren't even aware of the comments.
Haven't heard anything at all.
No, haven't heard anything at all.
Oh, he said the wrong thing, didn't he? I mean, it's un-Australian.
Because pre-polling has already opened, Jeremy Hearn will remain on the ballot paper for the seat of Isaacs, which is currently held by Labor's Mark Dreyfus.
The Liberal Party has shown that it thought that it was okay to pre-select someone who would express these abhorrent Islamophobic views.
But Jeremy Hearn isn't the only candidate to fall before Election Day. Steve Dixon resigned from One Nation yesterday over the so-called strip club scandal, while a handful of Liberal candidates stepped down due to concerns over their citizenship status. And Treasurer Josh Frydenberg was quick to point out the Labor Party has also had its issues.
I won't be lectured on these matters by the Labor Party, who've had to disendorse their Senate candidate in the Northern Territory for anti-Semitic views. You've seen Melissa Park in Western Australia have to remove herself after her unacceptable views. And as of 9 o'clock this morning, the Labor Party in the seat of Goldstein is still preferencing an independent with anti-Semitic views ahead of the Liberal Party.
Almost 250,000 Australians have already cast their vote at pre-polling booths, nearly double the figure recorded at the same stage of the 2016 federal election campaign.
Stephanie Boris reporting. The coalition government is facing a significant challenge from independent candidates in this election, and in rural and regional areas, the independents are capitalising on frustration with the Murray-Darling Basin plan. In the regional Victorian seat of Indi, voters may even make history by electing two independents in a row. As regional affairs reporter Lucy Barber reports.
A cockatoo.
Yeah.
A cockatoo holder.
Yeah, where are you going to put them, Dennis?
In the front garden.
Yeah, in the trees. In the
Wangaratta trees. Local Dennis has dropped into Helen Haynes's campaign headquarters. He's buying a bright orange laser-cut cockatoo.
They're all bespoke cockatoos.
The birds sit amongst a swathe of handmade fundraising merchandise, including scrunchies, earrings, grocery bags and brooches.
Places where they normally, you know, wouldn't be wearing a political T-shirt, you'll notice they're wearing an orange cockatoo. It's kind of a subtle little wink to say, yeah, we're part of this independent movement.
Orange is the colour of Voices for Indi, the grassroots group that helped Cathy McGowan turn Indi in northeast Victoria independent after decades of conservative stronghold. She famously and narrowly won it from Liberal Sophie Mirabella, who disaffected voters felt had taken her country seat for granted. Ms McGowan has retired, and Voices for Indi anointed Ms Haynes, a nurse and midwife, to try to keep it independent.
But Cathy and I describe ourselves very much as same stable, different horse.
If she wins, she'll make history as the first independent to succeed another in a federal seat. But she's fighting a tough three-cornered contest with the Liberals and Nationals. She insists Voices for Indi is a people's movement, not a political party. But in this electorate, which stretches from alpine peaks to towns, farms and tourist hotspots, not everyone's convinced that the independent experiment has worked.
I believe you're better off with a member of a major party representing your seat, because then the promises that they say they're going to give before the election, you've got more chance of getting.
Major parties dislike losing prized seats, so the Liberals are determined to win Indi back. They're putting their faith in engineer and skateboarding father of four, Steve Martin.
I'll be a hard-working local member that listens. One that always tries to look after particularly small business.
He's hoping to benefit from Nationals' preferences. That party is being represented by farmer and former Wodonga Mayor Mark Byatt.
I've had three generations in this region, and you understand the region, you understand the depth and the diversity of the region. I think that's important for people.
Independents often struggle to win these regional contests because of low profile, a lack of resources and the sheer size of rural electorates. Cathy McGowan was well known, so a win for Helen Haynes would prove that a grassroots movement with a local party-like structure can propel a low profile independent candidate into the corridors of power.
Lucy Barber reporting. Heading overseas now to the escalating violence in Venezuela, where the opposition leader Juan Guaido today moved to grab power in his country by calling for the military to push President Nicolas Maduro out of office. Mr. Guaido is recognised by dozens of governments, including Australia's, as the nation's rightfully elected president. But as he led his supporters onto the streets today, his call for the Venezuelan armed forces to join didn't go as planned. Nick Grimm reports.
In the suburbs of the US city of Miami, there were celebrations as Venezuelan immigrants welcomed news that supporters of the nation's opposition leader, Juan Guaido, had taken to the streets. Promising the campaign to force his rival Nicolas Maduro from power was reaching its final phase. For 20 years, my country has been kidnapped, this Venezuelan says. We haven't known liberty for 20 years. I couldn't be free. I'm a doctor who had to flee my country like a rat. But as events unfolded in the Venezuelan capital, the hope for freedom was still some way off, with protesters clashing with troops loyal to the Maduro government amid gunfire and clouds of tear gas. Video capturing the moment a National Guard armoured car ploughed into a crowd of Juan Guaido supporters. He's the man regarded by more than 50 nations as Venezuela's acting president since widely disputed elections were declared invalid in January. Early today, he promised his supporters he had the military backing he needed to take control of the country.
We're speaking to the armed forces, and today it is clear that the armed forces are with the people of Venezuela and not the dictator.
But as the day unfolded, that was actually far from clear. While some soldiers were on the streets supporting the opposition, they appeared too few in number to topple the Maduro government. US President Donald Trump taking to Twitter to claim the socialist government was being propped up by Cuban forces. He's threatened sanctions against Cuba in retaliation. Members of his senior administration also claiming that Nicolas Maduro was ready to board a plane to flee the country when Russia intervened and persuaded him to stay. US National Security Advisor John Bolton.
We've made it clear to Russia in both public and private statements throughout this that we regard the actions that they've taken in Venezuela as something that we regard with the utmost seriousness, and particularly now when innocent Venezuelan civilian lives are on the line, we expect the Russians not to interfere in what's happening in Venezuela.
Russia and Cuba on one side, the United States on the other. The Maduro government's ambassador to the United Nations, Samuel Moncada, accusing the White House of orchestrating an international conspiracy to topple Venezuela's elected leader.
This was not a domestic event growing from within. No, this came from abroad.
Juan Guaido's supporters had hoped the day would end with him finally assuming the powers of president, But at this stage, it's still no clearer when the outcome of Venezuela's political crisis will be determined.
Nick Grimm reporting. If you've spent time in the tropics of northern Australia, you'll have encountered a frustrating reality. You can't swim in the sea in summer because of the deadly box jellyfish. Now, Australian scientists say they've discovered an antidote to the creature's venom, as Amelia Turson reports from Darwin.
It's tourist season in Darwin, but despite the heat and the humidity, few will brave going swimming in the city's beaches. It's because of the box jellyfish. German tourist Yumi Kershoss has seen the signs everywhere.
There is written that we have to pay attention because there are box jellyfish here around. And it's very dangerous.
A large dose of the venom can kill you in minutes, making it amongst the most deadly venom in the world. But now the fear of death from a sting in northern Australia and other places like Indonesia could become a thing of the past, with researchers at the University of Sydney discovering an antidote. Associate Professor Greg Neely was part of the research team.
So we were looking at how box jellyfish venom actually causes pain, and what we did was a screen where we turned off every gene in the human genome and looked to see which genes in the human genome that the jellyfish venom needs to act.
After they found that genome, they figured out how to starve the jellyfish's venom of what it needs to kill.
And that completely turned off the venom's ability to kill cells.
The research team then tested their antidote on mice and rats.
That was the eureka moment, is that this is actually could work as an antidote and it's also safe.
They're now hoping to develop it into a topical application that could be stocked by lifesavers or diving crews. And while that might sound difficult and expensive, Professor Neely says it shouldn't be.
Well, the drug is already known to be safe in humans, so now we just have to basically show efficacy for jellyfish venom. So it could be quickly, within a year or two.
But to work, the antidote needs to be applied within 15 minutes of the jellyfish stinging you, meaning it'd have to be kept close by at beaches or with diving crews.
To make the drug is really cheap. We should be able to make something cheap, affordable, that can last in a boat.
That's Professor Greg Neely from the University of Sydney. Amelia Turzon with that report. The ANZ Bank has reported a 5% fall in its half-year profits today. Chief Executive Shayne Elliott said the results were weighed down by the falling housing market and the effects of the Banking Royal Commission. The ABC Senior Business Correspondent Peter Ryan has been looking at the ANZ's numbers and he's with me now. Peter, on the surface this looks like a bad result for the ANZ, but its share price has risen. Explain that to us.
Well, Eleanor, it's correct to say the net profit is down 5% to $3.2 billion, but the bank's preferred measure of cash profit, which is what the analysts and investors really care about, is up by 2%. That was ahead of analyst expectations for something a bit softer, which is why the shares were up close to 3% in late morning trade. But the reality is that these are a very cautious set of numbers, and Chief Executive Shayne Elliott made no excuse for sounding a bit somber this morning, with home loan growth down significantly, a lot of that due to the ANZ's own tighter lending standards and continuing customer remediation from the Banking Royal Commission. But Mr. Elliott says the ANZ is well progressed in changing its ways, signalling the days of stellar profits are probably over in the face of tougher scrutiny from the community, government and regulators.
We recognise that community, regulatory and customer expectations have changed, and it's not the time to focus on absolute market share growth. This is the time for prudent and targeted growth, recognising that the cost of getting it wrong will be more than just credit losses. We do not believe there is any going back.
There's also a lot of concern, Peter, about a softening economy, given that the Reserve Bank might cut interest rates to stimulate the economy. What is Mr. Elliott saying about that?
Well, money markets at the moment, Eleanor, are seeing about a 50-50 chance of a rate cut to 1.25% next Tuesday. That's closely watched, as always, but especially right in the middle of an election campaign. And it will be interesting to see how the government, the opposition, react to any particular rate cut. Now, Mr. Elliott was pretty careful not to offer any advice to the Reserve Bank, but he says the housing correction is creating a bit more pain than probably expected as borrowers, particularly investors, renegotiate their loans with slow or no wages growth at all, another factor weighing on households.
Our data shows that there is more stress in parts of Australia, particularly for retail borrowers and particularly those converting from interest only to principal and interest. Unsurprisingly, some of that is due to stubbornly low wage growth, the fall in house prices, and the extension in time it takes for houses to sell.
That's the ANZ Chief Executive Shane Elliott, the ABC's Senior Business Correspondent Peter Ryan with that analysis. And that's all from the World Today team for this Wednesday. Linda Mottram and the PM team will be along this evening, and we'll be back at the same time tomorrow. I'm Eleanor Hall. Have a lovely afternoon.
There's a man whose words are all through the Mueller report.
White House counsel Don McGahn has now met extensively with Robert Mueller.
Don McGahn had a choice: help Donald Trump potentially commit a crime or resign. The curious story of history repeating itself.
There is no doubt at one stage I realized that the best course for me to protect myself was to tell the truth.
That's this week on Russia If You're Listening. Available now on the ABC Listen app and wherever you get your podcasts.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.